This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Anthony Scoma. Today in the program, a panel looks at the current forces at play in the labor market, the demand for more workers, and the way this has contributed to a rise in strikes across U.S. industries. According to a new Deseret News and Hinckley Institute poll, 54% of Utahns somewhat or strongly approve of labor unions, 35% disapproved, and 10% said they didn't know. A nationwide Gallup poll shows Utah trails the rest of the U.S., which recorded a 68% approval for labor unions last August, a historic high not seen since 1965. While Utah's favorability towards unions is highly correlated with those who identify as very liberal and markedly lower with the very conservative, 42% of Utah Republicans said they approve the labor organizing occurring under Starbucks, Amazon, and other major companies. Today's panel of experts discusses the tight labor market, the rise in striking workers, and the effects of the COVID-19 pandemic on the economy. Included in the panel is Dean Baker, visiting professor at the University of Utah's Economics Department, Mark Nold, chief economist at the Utah Department of Workforce Services, Byron Russell, co-chair of the Utah Division of Multicultural Affairs, and Melva Sein, president and CEO of the Utah Restaurant Association. Moderating today's discussion is Natalie Gochner, director of the Kemsey Gardner Policy Institute. This forum was recorded on September 29th, 2021. Here is your moderator, Natalie Gochner.
Mark, I'm going to come to you first as the state's prominent labor economist. We're going to be talking about the notion of a labor shortage. And to get at that, we have to understand the definitions, how things work. And so I want you to first kind of help us understand, what is unemployment? What is Utah's current unemployment rate? How is it calculated? Just give us that context for just understanding how we measure unemployment.
Okay. Well, in that context, I'm sharing a screen. Can you see a spreadsheet?
It's perfect for you to start out with a spreadsheet, Mark.
Okay. What we do is these numbers come from the United States Bureau of Labor Statistics. They do the actual calculation work. We feed them information. We work hand in hand with them. But when you look at the definition of the labor force, or let's call it the potential labor force in any state across the nation, is anyone 16 and older, that population. So that would be over here in this column. That is the potential labor force. But the actual labor force is only those who are doing one of two things, either working or looking for work. And this is the official unemployment count, the official employment count. And when I say looking for work, I mean they don't have a job, but they have looked for a job within the last month or the last 6 weeks. If you had a job and you don't have a job, but you haven't looked in the last 6 weeks, and you still might take a job, well, you're not in the official unemployment rate. So the official labor force then is the employed plus the unemployed. And it's been hit rather interestingly during the COVID setback. I seem to have lost a variable right here, but our interest rate was 10%, excuse me, unemployment rate was 10% in April of 2020, and it fell to 7.562. You can see it coming down to where we're actually at 2.6% right now in our unemployment rate. Now, I want to talk about the labor force participation rate.
Hey Mark, will you pause there for just a second? Let's get Dean to comment here. So Dean, Mark's basically walking through how labor force accounting happens in our nation. Would you want to add any color commentary before we jump over to the labor force?
Well, I don't have too much to disagree with him, Mark. Really nothing. It's all pretty much definitional. I assume he's going to make points I could say here. But we've had this foreign labor force participation, and that's always a big variable. Obviously, this is related to the pandemic, and we are coming back up. And the question is how quickly. But that is, one of the big issues, and we come back to this, is that how labor force participation rates change over time. So we've seen in general, if you go back over the last, 4 or 5 decades, however far you want to go back, there's been rising labor force participation among women for obvious reasons. More choices are open to them, less discrimination. Also women having fewer kids. There's a number of factors going on there. So rising labor force participation among women. Among men, it's actually been falling. And usually when we focus on this, I'm sure Mark will say this, we tend to look at people who we think of as being in their prime working years. So obviously, a lot of college age people work. I suspect most of the college students we have here work at least part-time jobs or work in the summer. But the people we expect most to be working are people from 25 to 54. So that's what we refer to as prime age. And that's often the key to the story. Again, all younger people work, people were over 55, I suspect a few of us in that category, also work. But that's where, what we think of as the bulk of the labor force is those prime age groups. So I'm sorry, Mark, I probably went on.
Yeah, very good. No, that's good. So Mark, I know you have a picture of labor force participation rates. And this shows some of the history that Dean spoke of from 1978, that rise.
Yes, as Dean said, the labor force participation rate has gone up during this time period. It, for two reasons in the state of Utah, and this would be national. Number one is you have all the baby boomers coming into the labor force here in their young ages, and young people are more active in the labor force than older. So the more youngers you put in your equation, the more it's going to rise. And then Dean also spoke about a newer mindset, so to speak, in this time period where women became much more active in the labor force. It rose to 72% in the state of Utah. You could compare that to like 66 or 68 nationally. We usually have a higher participation rate. For 20 years, it held at 72-ish percent until this onset of the Great Recession. Now, this blue line is showing the decline in the labor force participation rate, the actual one. But again, that can happen because people leave the labor force. They can get discouraged. This was a long period of sluggishness in the economy, and people actually stopped looking or participating in the labor force. The green line shows what the labor force participation rate is expected, or we calculate it to be. In Utah, straight up given demographics and its ceiling or its potential. Why it's declining is because back is a bit of an aging in our labor force. Right at the onset of the Great Recession, only 11% of our entire 16 and older population was older than 65, which is the lowest participation rate of all age cohorts. 10 years later, basically, it's now, the 65s are now 16% of our labor force. And so we put a ceiling on our labor force participation rate at around 68.5%. Leading into the COVID downset, we were at a maxed out full employment economy. So that, I'm gonna let it speak for itself.
Hey, Mark, I need you there to explain to people what's the difference between the blue line and the red line.
Sure. The blue line is the labor force participation rate, which again is the combination of those who are working and looking for work. Didn't mean to move that, but so this is the amount of people in the labor force who are employed, and this would, the gap would be the unemployed. So you can actually, here's an example, you can actually increase employment, but lower the labor force participation rate because people, so to speak, in the white zone are just leaving, jumping on out because of not finding jobs. Yes, the pandemic hit. People can't, you know, were staying active and bounced back. Some went back to work, many didn't. But as time went on, the realization was that the jobs weren't there at the moment. So they left the labor force, even though the employment was bouncing back. So the unemployment rate went down for two reasons. Positively, because people were getting reemployed, for a negative reason, because people were getting discouraged, they're sitting on the sidelines. But recently, they're making improvements.
Yeah, okay. Now let's just bring in Melva and Byron to the conversation from the standpoint of, you know, Mark and Dean have really painted a picture of an economy, a labor force that took it in a very powerful way, this shock because of the pandemic. And now as we come out of it, we're facing a really tricky challenge because we've got very low unemployment rates. Mark's mentioning, 2.6% in Utah. At the same time, we've got people on the sidelines, as evidenced by Mark's comparison of the potential labor force versus the actual labor force, and the difference between labor force participation ratios and POP to employment ratios. Melvin, let's go to you. What is it like? What are you seeing in the food and beverage industry?
Well, thank you, Natalie. And it's great to hear the other information about the job market in the state of Utah. What we're seeing is that there's definitely a shortage, which means restaurants who used to be open probably 6 days a week are now open 4 days a week. The hours where they used to open at 8 o'clock in the morning and be open till 10 o'clock at night, hours have been cut to try and accommodate. And in some instances, you'll see restaurants who haven't made those alterations presently. And as a result, people wait longer when you go into a restaurant. So having people's expectations meet where we are as far as the industry is concerned. So people will walk into a restaurant and see, you know, plenty of tables. And there are plenty of tables empty, but if we fill those tables, we can't serve those people in an adequate amount of time. And so in the restaurant industry, the word used to be consistent. We want to be consistent with our employees, with how we greet people, all of those kinds of things. And now that has changed to flexible. We have to be flexible in the number of employees we have, the hours, the menu, just everything has to be flexible, and we survive from day to day.
Yeah, very interesting. I'm going to go back to you, Dean, and just ask for your question now. So we've got, well, for your input now that, so we have, you know, Melva saying from her point of view, we absolutely have a labor shortage. Is there a consensus about that from your standpoint?
Well, I think there's close to one. I'll just say I'm generally one who's skeptical on the claims of labor shortage because I'm used to hearing that you know, employers will claim, oh, we can't get enough workers. And then, you know, as an economist, what I always do is I look at the data and I go, well, are you paying higher wages? And oftentimes the answer is no. I mean, I remember a few years ago, there were all these articles in the media, business press about how the trucking industry had this horrible labor shortage. And I took a look and they're paying less. If you adjust it for inflation, they're paying less than they had done two decades ago. So you go, well, if you're, you know, try raising wages, that might. So that's generally how I look at it. I go, okay, you have a labor shortage. Are you raising wages? Well, in this case, the answer is yes, they are raising wages. So if you look at, you know, you can look at this nationally, look at it in Utah nationally, the annual rate of wage increase over the last 3 months in the restaurant industry are actually slightly larger, leisure and hospitality. So that include hotels, but mostly restaurants. It's over 20%. And here in Utah, it's about 24%. So that is a case, they're raising wages, you know, so it's, you know, you're raising wages, and obviously a lot of places are still having a hard time finding workers. So I think that corresponds to a story of labor shortage. So in this case, again, I'm usually the skeptic, but in this case, it is a labor shortage.
Right. Byron, I'm going to bring you into the conversation, but I want to ask Mark one last question. Just on this point, then we'll come to you. Mark, what's the data on wages? So, you know, Dean makes the point that show me a labor shortage and I'll show you wages that are too low, but he concedes that wages are on the rise. What are we seeing on wages?
Good question. Utah specific data has a little bit of a lag yet, so I need some time before the employer reporting would actually reveal it to me, but I'm going to rely on national data here. And in the long run, that's the same story. Utah mimics it, you know, maybe the levels are a little different and so on. But what is being seen at the national level is dichotomies in the actual wage increases. And during the pandemic, the higher end, higher education, higher paying jobs, they really didn't lose their jobs. So the employers were still recruiting the same way through that whole process. The wage gains, 3% working on 4%. You had, on the other hand, the lower skilled, let's call it the service industries, lost large amounts of job during the pandemic. They were idle for, you know, 12 months or longer. And then they reawakened in mass when we all decided COVID was over in April and May. And that's the instant demand for labor and the labor shortage. The labor force doesn't respond as quickly. It's, you can instantly ask for jobs, but labor is much more sticky, much more frictional in taking its time and getting back to the labor force. It needs to be enticed back. Wages are a great way to do it. So actually at the national level, you're seeing in the lower skilled areas, 20% wage gains over the last year that are going on versus higher end wages, higher skill wages, 3% job growth. And so that's a tale of, well, who was impacted the hardest in the pandemic and who's trying to make the most rebound?
Wow, that 20% number is a big number, Mark. Yeah, I don't hear you see the 20% figure often. Okay, Byron, thanks for your patience as we get to you. You know, it was very clear in the data that Mark put up, the incredible disruption, the shock of the pandemic, the literal, you know, closing down of some entities for a period of time in our nation, a little less so here in Utah. How would you summarize the impact on Utah's multicultural communities?
Well, in perspective, I think maybe I should share that I was co-chair of the Utah Multicultural Advisory Committee to the COVID-19 response. And that probably went on for about 18 months. And we have sunsetted that, but we're still working with that. And Natalie and I had the honor of working together from some of the perspectives of the economic impact. And so I think it's interesting, you know, as we look at state unemployment in different parts of the country by race and ethnicity, there's a report by the Economic Policy Institute that does show these trends that I think Dean Mark and Melva have discussed. You know, and as the vaccine distribution accelerated in the first half of 2021, you know, the economy really began to recover. However, that recovery was a bit uneven across groups, right? So the racial ethnic gaps persisted, and, you know, the latent vaccine skepticism across the certain parts of the country remains truly a potential headwind to a full recovery. And so when I talk about that, I also talk about women, and women, especially women of color, have had significant impacts. They are really on the front lines of essential work and industries that are most hurt. Melva, obviously, her industry is one of them. And so when you think about the initial Hispanic, Latinx population, 23% of that initial job loss was due to the pandemic. And so, you know, as Latinos face large losses in unemployment, again, Latinas in the service industry are truly overrepresented in this sector. And I think that we have to think about that gender issue, as well as the gender plus the Latinx issue. And so, and there's a reason I think that we look at that number, because it was real. I mean, the fact that the Hispanic and Latinos were 1.7 times more likely to contract COVID, there were, 4.1 times more to be hospitalized and about 2.8 times more to likely to die. So I think when you're talking about the reality of the urgency and the immediacy of what's on people's minds, we recognize that there is a correlative understanding of some of the behavior of unemployment, maybe some of the people in those workplaces that maybe are reticent to go back. But there's also the issue of immigrants. And I don't want to piece that into a particular culture, but immigrants are in a more vulnerable position in the labor market. And that's due to their less stable unemployment conditions and lower seniority on the job. And obviously there is, again, overrepresentation in that industry. And I think, you know, as we look at the industries like construction, food, as Melva had talked about, manufacturing, they're most reliant upon immigrants and immigrant labor. And so we need to be able to think about investing in that and those populations in that area and understanding those populations. And I think that's the work that we try to do.
Yeah, thanks, Byron. Really great to hear the points that you've made there. And it makes me want to ask Melva to just talk to us a minute. Melva, one of the issues that is on people's minds is how the federal unemployment benefit that came through the CARES Act and through the pandemic stimulus work, you know, that was eliminated early in our state, later in some other states, but how did the, what some would call more generous unemployment benefits, how did that impact the restaurant industry in our state?
So I think that that was a impacting factor. When we first did the PPP legislation and people were getting additional federal funds, there was really a need, right? The restaurant industry in the state of Utah in a matter of 45 days dropped from 111,000 people to 63,000 people. And that was going from March 18th when the closure was ordered to May 9th. When the industry was said we could open back up our dining rooms. So that's a huge, mostly we lost all of our trained people, right? And so since that time, the industry has been building back. And when we say, when we start talking about people becoming it, they say it takes 21 days to make a new habit. So people have been on unemployment for, 12 months, however long that, not just state unemployment, but federal unemployment. So yes, we did ask the governor if he would please consider what many other states were doing, and that was eliminating that and giving people incentive to go back to work, because that's the only way they were going to make a reasonable salary, because unemployment will not sustain a person. It will hold you over, but it will not sustain you. And right now in the state of Utah, labor costs, 84% of our industry are paying increased labor costs to encourage people to come and go to work. So they're making a lot more money than they would even receiving that $300 weekly benefit. But yes, we asked for that. We asked the governor to please, work to restructure that so that people were only receiving, and we were giving them an incentive to go back to work, because as Mark mentioned, salaries are going up. Hourly wages are going up. I mean, in Utah, we have a $7.25 minimum wage. There isn't anyone. I mean, in any of our restaurants, you're making a minimum of $10, $12, if not clear up to that $15 level with a sign-on bonus to try and encourage you to get out. So yes, and the industry is picking up for people who want to go back to work. The industry is picking up any loss that they would have felt. They're more than making that back.
That was Melva Sein, president and CEO of the Utah Restaurant Association. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. Today, a panel of experts discuss the labor market in the U.S. and Utah. Here again is your moderator, Natalie Gochner.
I wondered if Dean and Mark, if you would just briefly comment on the economic theory behind these expanded unemployment benefits and how that can affect a labor shortage. Dean, I don't know, did you watch that closely in our state? Because in most states, it was a September expiration, and in our state, it was the end of June or early June.
Yeah, that was true of a number of other states as well. This is actually something that's been researched heavily. So the basic argument here, or point at issue, is that if you give people more money in benefits, then they have an easier time getting by not working, in effect. So someone could say, well, I could work, and I understand wages have risen in the restaurant industry, but let's say someone's working at just $8, $9 an hour. I can work $8 or $9 an hour, 30 hours a week. So that gets me not very much money, that arithmetic, $270 a week. Well, you can get $300 a week in unemployment supplements in addition to your regular benefits. You go, I make more money by not working. So the argument was that you had a lot of people who were just saying, oh, I'm better off not working. Why should I work? So that would be the argument. Now, the question is, how does the data fit with that? And there have been a number of analyses. You actually had an even more generous benefit. It was $600 a week in the original CARES Act that ran from, I guess it was April until through August of last year. And it doesn't seem that that had a major impact. And we've also had some analyses, it's more recent, other states like Utah ended their benefits early. They ended nationally earlier this month. I think it was September 7th was the last day. But they looked at the earlier states and they have not found much of an impact. One person I follow closely, Rin Dubey, is the labor economist at the University of Massachusetts. He found very little impact in terms of the workers. So he's looking at workers who are unemployed, some impact, but not much. And actually what he found was that insofar as those people were more likely to look for work or to be working, it was offset by other people not working. One of the stories, very interesting story we've seen in this recovery, is there's been an unusually high employment rate among young people, 16 to 24. So what it seems is that as older people, I'm saying older, I just mean people in their 20s or 30s, so not old timers like me, but older people have dropped out of the workforce for whatever reason. It seems that's created openings for younger workers. And now when those people go back, those younger workers are being displaced. Now you could argue whether that's a good thing or bad thing, but the point is it's not a net change in workers.
Yeah. Child care looms large there for me, and homeschooling, you know, for those older folks that have, when I say older, late 20s and 30s that have dropped that late force. Mark, I know you have some data that shows, at least visually, some things we're seeing in Utah in this regard. Do you want to pull that up one more time and just share, go ahead and walk our viewers through what you're seeing here?
Sure. Again, we talked about this in the labor force participation rates, the employment to population ratio. But I think what you want to look at here is this dotted line is largely what I would call the reawakening of the entire Utah economy, not just Utah, but nationally in April, late March, April, that May period where we made a collective mindset that COVID was over and we were reopening the economy. Whether it is or not is irrelevant at this point in time. We thought it was, and we reacted that way, and the economy reopened. This is also about largely the time frame when we eliminated in Utah the federal UI benefits. And not only when exactly when it's eliminated, June 26th, but you would like to say when it was announced, because if you were a wise person on unemployment, you saw that 3 weeks down the road, this is cutting off. Maybe now's the time to go back out and look for a job or stay active. You can see these upticks in employment and the labor force participation rate on this side of the lines. Is all of this the unemployment benefit relief? No, it's not, but it coincides with it. And these upticks are also opportunities, those wage increases. There's a natural pullback into the labor force. There's also the, so to speak, eliminating the disincentive that the UI benefits may have eventually become at the end. And the combination of the two is making this uptick. When we did eliminate the federal extension, that was 12,000 people in Utah on unemployment who were no longer on unemployment. So you could, whether all 12,000 came out and got a job, we don't know. But we do feel that like a perfect storm of reopening the economy and then the early release of UI benefits here is giving us a labor supply. We are growing in the May, June, July, we went from 2.3% growth to 3.2 to 4.2 to 3.8% growth, and that's over 2 years. And what I'm saying is we have a lot of opportunities here in Utah. The national data and some of that is trying to find jobs in a United States economy that still doesn't have as many jobs as it did before COVID. We have 3.8% more jobs in the state of Utah than we did before COVID. So this economy is dynamic. It grows. It grows even with a pandemic in the midst of it.
Yeah, a stunning statistic. Okay, thank you, Mark. So we've got some questions that are coming in, and one follows right from this. And we'll go back to you, Melba, to ask this question. Is it possible that workers have moved from the food and beverage industry into other industries where people are not afraid of another shutdown or some of the instability that came with the pandemic in the food service industry?
We absolutely know that that's the case. When we lost, you know, half of our workforce in that 45-day period, we know that many of those people that we lost took jobs elsewhere. And that's the one thing that we hear when we start talking about the effects of the pandemic and this ongoing fear that sometimes is created with numbers and all of these other things regarding COVID, then we destabilize the workforce in our industry because yes, when will the next shutdown be? I mean, when the dining rooms were closed, most restaurants operated with 4 or 5 employees, did what they could to feed and take care of them, but it was huge.
Right. So Mark, what industries have grown in employees, given that Melba's saying that definitely some of theirs have not come back?
Interesting that we actually had several industries that were unaffected on paper, you know, in terms of employment counts through the pandemic, construction, the financial sector. There's one more that's eluding me at the moment, but oftentimes they were actually beneficiaries of the pandemic. It sounds interesting, but to combat the pandemic, they collapsed interest rates. That spurred housing activity. So construction was, a lot of the projects were already in place here in the state of Utah. I would say during the actual COVID itself, we had 40% of our industry base was still adding workers, employment. Others, you know, were getting the impact or being impacted, particularly to the service, the manual labor service occupations. Those were the ones that were hit the hardest because you're having face-to-face interaction during the, as a customer interaction, how you have to do work. Construction workers can go hide and do their jobs. Others that could telework, those industries were untouched. I mean, just to think about it, you have the restaurant industry sitting here talking, not the IT industry sitting here talking, because they didn't have trouble finding workers or were impacted during the shutdowns.
Byron, so we're talking about this sort of resorting of where people choose to work, where they want to work, where they can work. You gave us a lot of interesting stats about how COVID has impacted our multicultural community. What are you seeing when you advise state policymakers on the hardship that's felt in an environment where we've had, a tougher job picture? Now it's better, but a tougher job picture, but also just so much change and people having to still support their families.
I think that as you use that word, choose, right? I mean, I think people are making choices based upon an experience where they have learned that they are in a vulnerable place. And it would be very interesting to see if there is a correlation in people's desire to get different training or to move into other industries that are probably less vulnerable. Because I think people took a note while they were wondering how they were going to be able to survive, one, to be safe, two, to remove themselves from a vulnerable position, and three, just the dynamics of, as we look at the state being the number one in growth, we see these low unemployment numbers, we also see incredible expenses, right? So housing becomes a lot more expensive, more accessibility isn't near those who are working in these industries, especially as Melva had talked, a lot of these folks have to move further and further out. So your transportation costs to get into work to a vulnerable job then makes you start to think, and that behavior starts to change. And I'm not sure that everybody has the luxury to be able to shift their potential or their focus or their training or their ability, but it's a big, big deal. And I think that people are recognizing that as we look to what the Unified Economic Opportunity Commission decides to do and projecting an economy that's more equitable in 10 to 15 years, is how do we address that? What kind of training do we provide folks who feel that they want to be part of that? And, this is the commentary hat that I'm putting on, but you're thinking about issues of immigration reform, right? How does that actually translate into those who have potential visa requirements that allow them to be in industries that they aren't right now? And then, of course, there are the wage issues, the livable wage issues that meet some of those dynamics in our economy, including housing increasing.
Very well said, Byron. Okay, we've got questions coming in. And the first one here is a really sort of hardcore macroeconomic question. So I'll invite both Dean and Mark to respond to this. But the question is, are real wages, so wages adjusted for inflation, price change over time, are real wages growing strongly enough to pull people back into the labor force?
I'll take a first shot. Mark made an important point there, how we've had a distinction between growth at the top and growth at the bottom. So we haven't seen a lot of growth at the higher end, more or less keeping with inflation, depending what time period we're looking at exactly. We've seen rapid growth at the bottom. And to my view, I mean, that's a great thing. That's what you want to see, because we've seen the opposite over the prior four decades. People at the top did very well, and people who generally had less education, didn't have college degrees, in some cases didn't have high school, they didn't do well. So we're seeing this period, how long it will last, I don't know. No one knows, I don't think. But we are seeing rapid real wage growth. So we're seeing wage growth well in excess of inflation. Again, Melva referred to the restaurant industry. Mark said this too. We're seeing growth of more than 20% of wages in the restaurant industry. And in particular, I think they were looking at the same thing. We look at production non-supervisory workers. So this excludes the managers. So you're seeing rapid wage growth there. Will that pull people back in? My guess is it over time it will. I mean, I don't know we'll ever get to the same levels of employment in the restaurant industry we had back in before the pandemic, but I think we will be pulling people back into the labor force if we can maintain this sort of wage growth.
Yeah. Mark, you have something to add there? Because then I want to ask both of you a follow-up question about inflation and wage price spirals. So
sure. Everything Dean said is right on. He made the point that at the lower ends of the wage scales, they have been no gains or even regressions, you could say, with time. Now, if you were a genie who could control the economy and you would like to raise wages in the lower levels of the market, you have to make it convinced to do that. So what you would do, you would actually take labor away. You would shorten the supply of labor down in the lower areas, so they have to start bidding more for it. And that is the mechanism that would make it happen. Now, the genie didn't do it. The pandemic did it. And that's what we're seeing right now is as Dean said, how long will this last? Will it go long enough to reverse 3 decades worth of no real wage gains down in that lower areas? I probably not, but it is making movement, and it is making movement rapidly in this current environment because of the pandemic.
So you've got rising wages. The question was, is it enough to bring people back into the labor force? Maybe yes and no, because we don't have as many people. We've got rising wages, but we don't have as many people back as we need. The follow-up question that the questioners asked is, are we all just doing a reassessment of our priorities, and that the COVID sort of pause, if you will, changes our preferences about how much we want to work? And I'll invite that to anyone to comment on. It resonated with me because my husband's actually said to me many times, I miss COVID. Now, what's he meaning there? Of course, we still are full, you know, trying to get through this. I've got my mask right here when I'm not, you know, in my office alone. But what my husband's suggesting is that when we slowed down, there were some silver linings to that. Who wants to comment on that?
I can, but I don't want to dominate. I looked at it this way too. There are underlying currents in an economy, like there are underlying currents in an ocean. They have movements. They go with time. They usually go slow, but they build mass. And oftentimes, what releases it, or brings it to the forefront rapidly, are periods of sharp disruptions. Wars do that. Natural disasters do that. In this case, the pandemic's doing that. I call the pandemic the great experiment. Teleworking, everything was in place to do it, but the business community was reticent to let their workers go. The pandemic forced them to do it. The great experiment is it works. Well, now there's a new dynamic, new thoughts of how things go. This is all the way down into the lower skill segments of the economy too. Is this job, is the income I'm earning worth going out and doing some risk to myself in a pandemic environment? I think it's a great question. I think that people do, these kind of shocks make people do reassessments that quickly that might be made otherwise over time.
Yeah, let me just throw a couple things to add into that. I very much agree with those points. One of the things, I think you had the numbers up earlier here on the job quitting. We're seeing record number of people quitting their jobs. So what does that mean? I assume that means you have a lot of people who are quitting saying, well, is there something else I could do? Is it a better job? Maybe I want to work part-time rather than full-time. So people are making choices that way. They obviously feel they're in a position to do it. Because again, these are quitting. I'm just being clear. These are people they're not fired. They made a decision to leave. So they're thinking about different opportunities. The other thing that, you know, we were talking about the unemployment benefits, the supplements, there were also the pandemic checks. And, you know, how much, you know, people got $2,000 on top of an earlier $1,200. Well, you know, if you're earning $70,000, $80,000, $90,000 a year, that's probably not that big a deal. If you're earning $20,000 a year, that's probably more money than you've seen for quite a while. So I think what might be happening, and I'll say this is speculative, is that you have a lot of people that have money in the bank for the first time in their life, maybe, and they're saying, okay, maybe I could go to community college. Maybe I could, you know, work half time for a year or two, get a degree, get some training, get a better job, which if that is the case, again, I'm speculating here, but if that's the case, to my view, that's a great thing.
Yeah, I will just say sort of, anecdotally, it's not anecdotally, but just on the side, that I really agree with what Dean said. But one of the great mysteries of the pandemic recession in Utah is that Salt Lake Community College enrollment has not been robust. It's been, tilted negative. And that's been a real surprise to me. If someone else wanted to comment on this idea of changing lifestyles, was it you, Byron?
Yeah, I have to say that to what your husband said, I think that the pandemic is something I miss in a way, but I also had great perspective. And it was very a sense of humility, because every week, Monty and I would go out and we would buy groceries. And, you're thinking, we're going to go home, we're going to be safe, we're going to go on our Zooms, we're going to put on our masks and do that once a week. And our risk factor is less because we're out once a week. But I was also very mindful of those individuals who were working at the counter in the grocery store, who were working at Costco, and perhaps were vulnerable. But I also think that, to what I think Dean and Mark has mentioned, those of us who in our economy were able to get checks to be able to stay at home and be safe also had a lot of time to reflect. And that reflection in time perhaps made them realize, gosh, maybe I don't want to be in that vulnerable position. Golly, healthcare is really important because this pandemic is proving that I've got to get health treatment. And therefore, maybe the job that I was working in that doesn't offer health benefits, maybe I need to think about a career that allows me to have that basic need. And so I think that the pandemic gave us some time and space to reflect both positively and how to maybe improve our lives, maybe how to respect others and positions that we rely upon. I was having coffee just the other day, and one of my favorite servers at Bombera, I would go to lunch at Bombera on a regular basis because it's right on the block where I work. And, the server said that he wasn't going back into his position because he realized that he could make a living doing something different and more. And he had been at Bombera for almost 10, 15 years, I think. Yeah. So people have made huge shifts. And we thought that people who were working 15 years, in a position would stay there because it was the job security that they liked, but it just gave them time to reflect and make some huge changes.
That was Byron Russell, co-chair of the Utah Division of Multicultural Affairs. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. Once more, here's your moderator, Natalie Gochner.
Melba, a lot of comments made there about Bambara and about, the sort of impact on the labor force in the restaurant industry. I would just suggest you and ask you to comment, but I think that eating out is going to be more expensive in the future, not less. And I'm okay with that because of the sacrifices and the how much I enjoy it. And I just wanted to hear what your comment to that, because I know when I dine out now, I'm more grateful, both for the people and for the food.
Right, and that's what we hope, that all people will understand, and that patience, and that you'll go out for the experience of being with one another and enjoying an experience out. But we have always considered the restaurant industry the industry of opportunity. You can start out as the dishwasher and be the manager in a year. So there is opportunity for a rising salary and for greater, and no educational institution is as strong as actually being on the job training. And that's what these people receive. But one of the things that we experienced during this pandemic is that attitude of fear, that fear factor of, can I as an employee go into my place of employment and be safe? Can my customers come in and be safe? And this fear factor that we have used to destabilize much of our service sector industry, the restaurant industry, all of these sectors that are dependent on face-to-face communications. I mean, retail can survive. They've got internet. They've got these other things. We did okay. The restaurant industry was already trending before the pandemic for delivery, third-party delivery, and these other resources. That was already trending, but that didn't anywhere near make up for the losses that we had for our dining rooms. We lost $2.8 billion in restaurant sales during the pandemic, and now we're suffering from all of these other things. It isn't just labor shortage; it's higher rents, higher food costs. I mean, everything for us is going up at the same time that we are trying to recover. So we can't say that just because we say that there's no more guidance and we don't have to 6-foot distance, that our industry is recovered. Our industry is not recovered, and over 50% of our industry thinks it's going to be another 12 months before our industry is back to any normalcy of being able to provide the best service, the best experience, all of those things that we want to rise to, not only meet your expectations, but exceed them.
Yeah. Melva, I'm so glad you're on this forum because it really helps to hear that depth of, you know, detail of how this is impacting an industry. I want to do one more thing before we kind of move to our last round of questions, but I want to ask Dean and Mark to comment on what we call in economics a wage price spiral. And so the way I'm thinking about this is we've agreed on this forum that we have a labor shortage here in Utah, that wages are on the rise, that the impact of this has been uneven by industry, by race, ethnicity, as both Byron and Melva have demonstrated, that we've been changing our behavior. And I like how the point was made by Dean that there's a lot of cash out there, both from the stimulus, from the unemployment benefits, excess savings, pent-up demand. There's just a lot of pressure on aggregate demand, if you will. Well, a wage price spiral occurs when price increases occur as a result of wages. And that's the part of inflation that is sticky and could stay, right? We know that we have higher prices now because of rising supply costs and the supply chain and these things. But to both of you, and maybe we'll start with Mark and then let Dean give his perspective, and it's okay if you disagree, but do we have the beginnings of a wage price spiral and therefore long-term inflation expectations higher in the Utah economy?
The possibility is there, but I'll caveat it this way. It depends on where the price spirals are occurring. And when I say that, I mean in the layering of the economy. How essential is eating out for us as consumers? If the wages and the prices of the restaurants get higher, we'll walk away from it. We won't do it. Can we walk away from higher gasoline prices? Can we walk away from higher house prices or some of the other essential things? The powerful wage gains are happening in the industries where, you know, these are choices, not necessities. And so that, I'm not saying it won't happen, but that's what I'm looking at as I'm evaluating the answer to your question is how much will the public be willing to absorb the wage gains in industries that are disposable in terms of in their minds, or they could find another alternative or make a choice not to do this. I can't make a choice not to buy gas in this day and age and world. I need lodging. I need to pay for my housing and so on. But do I have to have these other products where we are seeing what we call these high wage gains in some of the lower skilled industry areas versus the higher skilled industry areas? Dean, you might have some additional comments on that or even see it a different way.
It's pretty much the same story. This is the question I think most macroeconomists are asking right now. And, you know, many, Larry Summers, who's, of course, the Treasury Secretary under President Clinton, and then the head of the National Economic Council under President Obama, so a very prominent economist, he he's been saying, oh, we got wage price spiral. It's be like the 70s. That's when everyone always refers to when we did have a wage price spiral. I don't think many people dispute that. I think it's possible, agreeing with Mark, but again, I think probably not. We have a lot of erratic price increases. Cars, we know both new cars and because of the shortage of new cars, used car prices have risen very rapidly. That's clearly a temporary shortage. That was due to semiconductor fire. Longer story, not worth going into. But that's not going to be an ongoing phenomenon. The big things to me are that we're in a very different economy than we were back in the 70s. And just the two most obvious ways. One, it's more internationalized. And two, it's much less unionized. So on the international side, question would be, oh, can we have prices rising rapidly here if they're not rising rapidly in Europe, in China, elsewhere? Probably not. We'll just buy the stuff from them. So that's a wide range of goods that basically we have a serious limit on the extent to which those prices could rise because we can get them internationally. The other point about weaker unions, our union membership in the private sector is about 6.5%. It would have been around 20 back in the 70s, over 20. What that means is that workers in many cases won't be able to get wage increases to keep up with price increases. An important point to remember is back in the 70s, a lot of people had contracts where their wages were literally indexed directly to inflation. So they were tied to the consumer price index. So if the consumer price index said that there's 10% inflation, well, your wages were going up, maybe not one-to-one, but some significant fraction of that. So we're in a very, very different world today than we were in the 70s. So I think, you know, placing a bet, I'd say more likely than not, we're not going to see the wage price spiral.
Super interesting. Thank you for sharing that perspective. Okay, we are down to just about 5 minutes left in the program. And I wanted to ask each of you the same question. And that is that we know that our governor, Spencer Cox, is in the final stages of preparing his budget proposal for the state. He's doing it at a time of great uncertainty when the state is leading the nation in economic growth, when the state, speaking of state government, is got a lot of money to spend. So the question is, what advice would you give Governor Cox to help with Utah's labor shortage? And I want to start with you, Byron, go to Melva, then we'll go to Dean, and we'll end with Mark.
Yes, well, I do think, and as I referenced earlier, that we really are going to have to look at certain visa status, people who are capable of working, who by law we don't allow to work in certain industries. And I also think that that includes, obviously, immigrants. And that's obviously my hat of commentary. However, I think that it shows, and there's demonstrative facts that show that those individuals who are out there, we certainly aren't tapping them into the workforce. And I think that that is something policy oriented and budgetary that the governor should consider.
Very interesting, Byron. And I'll just say that immigration reform to have more states' rights there, that would be a legal challenge. So you could put money towards the legal challenge. Melba.
Yeah, for us, we're working in many areas, and we would ask the governor to support our efforts because we're doing second chance training at the prison. We're also working in our youth detention facilities to give these young people a direction and a pathway for their life. And so it takes in financing and all of that to provide that training, as well as I think training is the key to stabilizing our industry again, getting people trained and understanding, because you think you can do it and you think anybody can enter and they can, but the more trained they are, the more skilled they are, the more willing they are to work and to stay working. And so we would ask the governor please to consider financing more training opportunity that is industry, it is industry based.
No, but what I like about that is I think of that truly as a role of government. We're very involved in the education of our workforce, and this would just be a really specific example of that. Dean?
Well, first off, I want to say I 100% agree with Byron on, you know, immigrants. And yeah, I'm not sure how much you could do at the state level, but we have somewhere around 11 million people here without documentation. And realistically, no one thinks we're going to get rid of them. So why shouldn't they be, you know, able to have full rights here. I mean, you could argue the morality of it, but it's just not a good situation. Getting to other issues, the longer term, slightly longer term education, whatever we could do to facilitate people getting additional skills, that's great. More intermediate transportation. I forget whether it's Byron or Mark made the point about people can't get to jobs. That's a big deal. So, you know, if you can't afford the rent in Salt Lake City, so you have to live some distance out, you have to be able to get in. So make sure we have good, you know, do what we can to improve the public transportation. The last point, this is immediate. We know there's a lot of people who still aren't working because they're worried about the COVID, the pandemic. So
it's a super great point, and we lost Dean on it right as he's making it. So we'll go to you, Mark, but I think where he was headed is that, yeah, people aren't working because of the pandemic. And if we can get a hold of this pandemic in our state, get these case counts lower, that will sure help.
Mark, yeah, that'll backfill our short-term needs. But I actually had the opportunity to present to the governor a month ago or so, and I brought this to the table that it's not my original thought. The Conference Board is an economic think tank out there, and they did a study recently and made a nice long white paper. Well, more than that, it was a good study on it. Their focus or their emphasis is that what we always called labor shortages and the emphasis on finding labor was always in the higher education areas. The reality is in this country, it's going to shift into the blue, what we'll call the traditional blue collar and manual service industries. That the demographics of this country are shifting into a long-term problem area, labor in those lower skilled industries. Their point is that for years, every year for a long time, 2% more of our entire labor force is moving up into higher education levels, to the point where if you keep building at the top, you lose potential of workers at the bottom, because people think of themselves as this is where I belong, not down in these other areas. And we have educated our country so far up the ladder, and it's a good problem, don't get me wrong, but there will be some fallout consequences where you are now actually making it harder to find labor in what was traditionally not a labor shortage problem in the lower skilled areas. And again, this goes back to that situation I was saying, those kind of things were happening slowly under the surface, but something like powerful like a pandemic can instantly bring it to the forefront and move it instead of something that would happen 5 years down the road to right now.
We're wrapping things up there. If you'd like to hear the full forum, you can find it on our website, kcpw.org. This program is made possible, in part, by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Anthony Scoma, your producer and host of this program. As always, thanks for listening.